From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
Are you ready?
Yeah. I don't know about this.
I can do it.
People cross borders for many reasons. To find work, to escape, to start a new life. Or to find the parent who left.
My mom says, when I miss her, I should look at the moon because she'll be looking at it too. She's been working in America for 4 years, so she can bring me there soon.
An intimate conversation about the making of the movie Bajo la Misma Luna, Under the Same Moon, with the screenwriter Ligia Villalobos. And the global pop of Canadian rockers, Pacifica. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan.
This is news from Latino USA. I'm Alex Avila. New Mexican Governor Bill Richardson was the focus of media scrutiny early in the week with his endorsement of Senator Barack Obama for the Democratic presidential nomination. Joining us to discuss this and other news affecting the Latino community is Univision's national news anchor, Maria Elena Salinas. Hola, Maria Elena.
Hi, Alex. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. So, Bill Richardson appeared on the weekend television news talk shows. He talked about his endorsement. We invited him to speak to us, but his office says the governor's not conducting interviews this week. So, is Richardson a Judas, as Democratic activist James Carville says, or is the media really blowing this whole endorsement out of proportion?
Well, it wasn't the media that called him Judas, remember? It was James Carville. And let's remember that Carville is on the Clinton side. But, Alex, what does seem to be very real is that all the strong language and negative campaigning that has taken over, really, the Democratic nomination race is affecting the party, and it's giving Senator John McCain an opportunity to campaign virtually unopposed, since, you know, Clinton and Obama are still focused on each other. Yeah, I have to be honest with you, I was not surprised that Richardson endorsed Obama. I didn't have any inside information or anything, just a gut feeling. And even though it's true that he's been very close to the Clintons for so many years, he served in the Clinton cabinet, you know, him and Bill Clinton watched the Super Bowl together, they were friends, but it fits more with his views and his style. Now, it's very possible that he made up his mind at the last minute, but, you know, I think he knew all along that he would endorse Obama and was either holding out for some reason or maybe waiting for the right time or some kind of offer from the other side.
Let's move on. Let's go to Governor Richardson's neighboring state of Arizona. As you know, that's a border state at the forefront of the immigration debate. Arizona's passed some of the strongest anti-immigrant laws in the country.
Right.
Recently, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund and the American Civil Liberties Union have challenged an anti-solicitation law in Phoenix. What can you tell us about this case?
This particular lawsuit by ACLU and MALDEF is against a law that prohibits people from soliciting employment or contributions from occupants in a vehicle while on the highway or even on the sidewalk. So basically what that means is that day laborers cannot ask for work or accept work from someone that's in a vehicle. And as we all know, you know, it's very common that in cities all around the country, you have groups of workers that gather in street corners, and they either have homeowners or contractors come by and employ them for the day. So the lawsuit, it's against the city of Cave Creek in Arizona, and it says that the law is a violation of free speech. And the interesting thing about this law is that it doesn't specifically talk about undocumented immigrants. I guess it's trying to be more broad, and it's trying to protect itself from legal challenges because it does not specifically mention anyone's nationality or immigration status. It just says that it applies to every single person that lives in Cave Creek.
That's true. Anybody, rich or poor, cannot solicit
exactly. On the sidewalks.
There. Recently, a new study commissioned by the Oklahoma Bankers Association shows that the state's new anti-immigration law will cost the state $1.8 billion in economic losses. Maria Elena, what strikes me isn't the money involved. I mean, $1.8 billion is a lot of money, but the fact that the Bankers Association noticed something going on here, and they're the ones that financed this study, your impressions of that?
You know, they've been making it very clear that they have no specific position on the immigration debate, but specifically on this one law, but that the reason why they commissioned the study is because they had reports from different banks of problems by companies that employ immigrant workers and also those who depend on immigrants as customers. For instance, there was a restaurant that had been, you know, making $5,000 payments to a bank each month, and that particular company closed its doors. There have been construction projects that have either been delayed or have been canceled because of lack of workers. You know, there have been a lot of people that have left the state ahead of this law taking effect. For example, Hispanic leaders have estimated that more than 20,000 undocumented workers, mostly in the Tulsa, Oklahoma area, left the state before that bill took effect because they didn't want to have to face this discrimination. They knew they wouldn't be able to get jobs. Also because it's affecting the image of Latinos. So you're losing not only undocumented immigrants that are a very important part of your labor pool, but you're also losing those who feel that they're being discriminated against and they're being indirectly affected by these very strict anti-immigrant laws.
Okay. Well, thanks, Maria Elena.
Thanks to you, Alex. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Maria Elena Salinas is a syndicated columnist and national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish language television network. For Latino USA, I'm Alex Avila.
It's Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now, a love story. The strongest kind of love between a mother and child. That love can make people do radical things. A mother will sneak into another country to find work. Her 9-year-old boy will up and leave Mexico to search for his mother. The film Bajo la Misma Luna, Under the Same Moon, explores the scars of separation that millions of families have, and not just immigrants. A personal story about the cost of separation from families and across borders. From Los Angeles, contributor Monica Lopez caught up with director Patricia Riggin and sent us this story.
My mom says, when I miss her, I should look at the moon because she'll be looking at it too. She's been working in America for 4 years, so she can bring me there soon.
Carritos?
Mommy! But when my grandma died, I couldn't wait anymore.
La Misma Luna, or Under the Same Moon, is a bilingual feature film in Spanish with occasional English subtitles. It was directed by Patricia Riggin and written by Ligia Villalobos. The movie depicts the human side of the immigration story, told through the lives of a mother and son living on opposite sides of the border.
The first thing that struck me was that this was a love story. In this case, between a mom and a child.
Riggin and Villalobos collaborated on the script for about a year.
I thought it was a very universal story. You know, family separation has been something that has happened in all periods of time, in all cultures. And in this case, it was, you know, the context is the border between Mexico and the U.S. And being Mexican and living in Los Angeles, I felt that I knew this reality.
Part of this reality is told through the character of Rosario, played by Mexican telenovela actress Kate del Castillo, who is employed as an under-the-table domestic worker. She earns money in part to send to Mexico to support her son, Carlitos, played by Adrián Alonso, best known for the film The Mask of Zorro. The characters are fictitious, but as Riggin explains, the circumstances are quite real.
It's based on 4 million true stories, which is the amount of women that are living in this country with that circumstance, you know, having been forced to leave a child back in their hometowns and moved here to provide for them. We've also been listening and hearing and reading of children now taking on this very dangerous journey. So in a way, it's not based on one story, it's based on many, many.
Part of those stories involves human smuggling. In this scene, an inexperienced human smuggler, played by America Ferreira, and her brother place Carlitos in the hollowed-out seat of a passenger van and attempt to sneak him through a border checkpoint.
Mexican or U.S. citizen?
U.S. citizen.
Passports? How long were you in Mexico?
Four days.
4 days.
get out of the car, please?
I'm sorry, is there a problem?
Not yet. Open the trunk, please.
What are we doing?
Open the back door. Take out the suitcase and place it on the table, please.
The scene is tense, and some may question the risks taken by the various characters. Throughout the movie, the relationships of the characters to the underground economy of undocumented immigration are revealed to an audience that might not be fully aware. In this case, the sibling smugglers plug into this economy as a way to pay for their college tuition. The movie keeps the focus on the human experience from an undocumented immigrant's perspective, although many of the scenes feel as if they could be based on real-life reportage of current U.S. immigration policy. Again, Patricia Riggin.
It wasn't intentionally political. I actually tried not to make a political film and really concentrate in the human side. Now, being truthful to these characters, there's always a political angle to it because they are immigrants, they are here undocumented, but that's, you know, that's not the core of the story, but it is there.
And politics is not the core of the story. In fact, far from it. This warm and sometimes funny movie has already received wide acceptance at various festivals and from audiences of all backgrounds. Under the Same Moon is currently playing in theaters nationwide. For Latino USA, I'm Monica Lopez in Los Angeles.
Getting a feature-length film made is no easy task. You need a good script, lots of money for production, and then someone to distribute. Making a film that deals with a controversial subject, like undocumented immigrants, can make it all the more difficult, maybe even impossible. When screenwriter Ligia Villalobos began the script for Under the Same Moon, she knew it would not be easy and would not likely get major studio backing. But her hard work paid off when positive reviews at the Sundance Film Festival sparked a bidding war for distribution. I'm joined now by Ligia Villalobos from Los Angeles. Welcome to Latino USA, Ligia.
Thank you very much for having me.
So when you first wrote this screenplay, what was the message? What was the story? What made you sit down and write this movie?
When I was originally approached to write a movie about the issue, what they wanted to do was to tell a story of how difficult it would be for a young boy to cross the border illegally. And I actually felt that that story of crossing the border, the difficulty of crossing the border, had already been done with El Norte. And it had been done in a wonderful way and in a truthful way. So I really didn't want to tell that story again. So what I pitched to the producers that were thinking about doing a movie about the subject was the story that I want to tell is about the displacement of children as a result of their parents coming to live in this country to work. And what I wanted to do thematically was talk about abandonment issues and what happens emotionally and psychologically to these children that are left behind. And in a way, I wanted to talk about my own issues with, you know, feeling as a child left behind by one parent or the other. In my case, it was divorce. And I was able to hide, in many ways, my own story in this immigrant experience. But it really wasn't about, for me, it was never about doing an immigrant story. It was to be set in an immigrant setting, but it was really about having a movie where the voice of these children was heard. And what happens to them as a result of their parents' decision.
You know, it's interesting because as a reporter, I have witnessed the smuggling of Mexican children across the border. And for me, these stories have been emotionally devastating for me as a reporter, just witnessing them.
Right.
And yet you feel like one of the things that you wanted to do was to not make a political movie, and yet this is such a political topic.
Yeah, and a lot of people have asked me if what inspired me were all of the protests that were happening 2 years ago, which is when we started shooting the movie. The immigrant world just was the perfect setting for it because I knew that there were so many mothers and so many fathers across the country that were forced to make this decision. And, you know, I don't think anybody should judge these people for what they have to do or they feel that they have to do. But I did feel that it was important to tell the other side. And that was the children's side of the story and what happens to them.
So what kind of pushback did you get from Hollywood? I mean, for, you know, a major studio to basically want to take this movie on, it means looking at the issue of immigration, undocumented immigrants. Some people call them illegal aliens. So what kind of pushback did you face?
You know, I never intended this movie to be done through the studio system. I really didn't. The people that originally approached me was an independent producer and an editor who wanted to do this really small film. I don't really think that this movie would have ever been done by the studio system. It's very small. It has a very tumultuous subject matter. It has no stars that American audiences know. And so I really think it would have been very difficult to do it within the system. But I think when you tell a good story and when you have an audience connecting emotionally to the story, that is what made five studios bid on this film. But I think that the movie had to be done independently. It had to go to Sundance and it had to get distribution that way. I don't think it's a movie that the studios would have made. But I think a lot of times within the studio system, they have to figure out, can we market this movie? Are we touched by this movie when we see it? For them to really get a sense of what they can do for their audience. But I'm hoping that a movie like this that was done independently and that was sold and that was sold for as much money as it was opens the doors for other movies like this to get made. You know, this is the first movie that Fox Searchlight is releasing that is a Spanish language film. And so they have had to also learn the process in terms of the marketing campaign of the movie. How do you reach this enormous audience that is the Latino audience in this country? And hopefully, you know, certain good decisions that they have made along the way or the way that they have decided to market the movie will make this movie successful for other movies like that to be made so that these movies don't always have to be done independently. You know, it would be great if the studios start to realize the enormous audience that we have out there with Latinos. There's over 40 million of us in this country. There are so many stories that can be specifically targeted to this audience. And, you know, the success of this movie will hopefully open the doors to other filmmakers, other writers, but also open the studios to see that there is an audience out there for these kind of films.
There's so much buzz. I mean, I was hearing buzz about this months ago, and of course you had told me about it years ago. So what is the one piece of advice of that, you know, young Latino, Latina, or whatever background they may be, young person who says, I know I've got a movie in me,
right?
But they feel entirely daunted. What's that piece of advice?
I would just say two things. The first thing is that you have to prepare yourself. I think that a lot of times we feel that because we have a good story, someone should listen to it and someone should make it. And then we sort of want to skip the process of actually learning how to write a script, learning how to pitch an idea, learning what the structure is of a screenplay. And I think that those things to start out are enormously important. And hopefully the rest will come later.
Ligia Villalobos, I'm so proud of you, and I'm so glad that this movie's out, and I hope it's a big success.
Enjoy the film, and thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to talk a little bit about it.
Ligia Villalobos is the screenwriter for Bajo la Misma Luna, Under the Same Moon. It's in select theaters now. In a minute, surfing the waves of global pop with Canadian trio Pacifica, coming up on Latino USA. Stay with us.
You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. From tropical beaches to towering mountains, the vast landscapes of the Pacific coast are inspiring. But they're forged from the destruction wrought by the sea and by volcanoes. For the musicians of the band Pacifica, that trial through fire is precisely what they seek through their music. Una niña que por tu pie ya camina siguiendo tus pasos y tu pie. Fuiste tú la voz, el extraño sonido que hacemos unidos tú y yo. Lead singer Silvana Kane knows the Pacific well. Born in Lima, Peru, she emigrated to Vancouver, Canada. There, she joined forces with Canadian guitarist Adam Popowitz, writing songs with a global pop feel. Their sound was reinforced by Toby Peter, a Canadian dubwise bass player raised in Barbados. So joining us from Vancouver are Silvana Kane, Adam Popowitz, and Toby Peter. They all frontline Pacifica. And hey, we've never had any musicians from Vancouver, let alone any Latinos from Vancouver. So hey, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us. Thank you very much.
So I put in your CD, you know, I get lots of CDs, but I put it on in my office and I couldn't turn it off. It's so soothing.
That's so nice. Thank you so much. Como el cielo que veo desde tu verde jardín y blancas las nubes de vainilla que forman mi alegría y yo me siento chiquitita con manitas.
How did this group, Pacifica, come together?
Well, Adam and I have known each other for a very long time. And we've been working together and writing together for many years. And we were playing a show almost 3 years ago now. And Toby happened to be back. He was touring for quite a while and had come back into town and saw our show. And we had a space on the stage for someone just like him. And it turned out that we just went into the studio, the three of us, and it was kind of a magical thing. The next thing we knew, we'd formed a band.
Oh, I love it. So, Silvana, you were born in Peru. You do vocals. Adam, you are a Canadian, and your musical background is new wave and classical. And Toby, you grew up in Barbados. So tell me about the Latin American musical influence up there in Vancouver, because you guys definitely got it going on in this CD.
We didn't intentionally make a Latin record. What we were trying to do was just all of us to satisfy ourselves individually within a group. And the songs just kind of came out in Spanish, which was a really nice surprise even for me.
Oh, how did it happen, Silvana? Tell me.
Well, you know, we just started recording, and I just found that all the words that were coming to my mind were in Spanish, which was super excelente. Ojos mirando estrellas.
The name of the album, it's your debut album, is Asunción, which means ascent. And in a lot of ways, the album does kind of grow. There's a sense of climax, and then there's kind of, you know, the coming down from it. So you guys thought about that, this thread, and did it kind of have a name, or was that also completely organic?
This is Adam speaking. Definitely, we intentionally wanted to have a common thread, a continuity. We wanted to have a theme to the album, the theme of music that resonated with us. We wanted every song to have a story and to have a sound, but all coming from a similar home.
We really wanted to have a record that we enjoyed listening to ourselves.
And finally, let's talk about the song Óyeme, which is really kind of, you know, a dip into the South American rock scene. You know, this kind of alegría, the happiness, embracing life. Óyeme means hear me. it that you guys want people to hear from Pacifica?
I think, this is Toby. I think the overriding feeling that we have, all of us, is just to make people feel good. It's kind of nice to have something come through the pipes which we can all sort of go, and feel better about things, you know? We need to have some vehicle to chill each other out, you know?
No wonder I liked it so much. I'm always looking for ways to chill out. I do too much intense work.
Right, and we feel the same way, you know? So that was part of our mission, was to make something that feels good.
Well, Pacifica also means it could be something very passive, Pacific in the sense. I don't know if it what would be the translation?
Well, Pacifica could be a very calm woman. Pacifica could be a state that is extremely calm.
You would say, estás muy pacífica, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. I really strongly believe that words are very powerful. And so whatever we named ourselves was going to carry forth in our career with each other. And, you know, there is a balance between the three of us, and we try to always maintain things in a peaceful way. And that is really the only reason we want to leave our homes, is to do something that's nice for the world and spreading some joy and some peace. It's a nice thing.
Thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA. It was a pleasure to have you, and I'm sure your new CD, Asunción, will be part of my family's hit parade for a while. That's kind of how it goes here. But anyway, Silvana Kane, thank you so much. Adam Popowitz and Toby Peter, great speaking with you. Send my regards to Vancouver, and thanks for joining us on Latino USA.
Un placer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The name of the group is Pacifica. The name of their album is Asunción.
I'm a gypsy back from the kitchen table, looking onto the tar-stained rooftops, smoking it all.
Latino USA was produced this week by Benjamin Jacob, Walter Morgan, Angela Maldonado, and Alex Avila. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. We had help this week from Katie Davis and Marsha Caldwell at NPR West. To listen to our podcasts, go to latinousa.org. Look for us also on iTunes. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world. On the web at kauffman.org. And Walden University, graduate degrees online for professionals who strive to make a difference. Walden University, a higher degree, a higher purpose. waldenu.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone.
When we study civil rights in our classroom, it always comes back as a conversation about, that's kind of like Beardstown when the Mexicans came.
Beardstown, Illinois. Maybe not a place you think of as being on the forefront of social change, but it is.
We have wonderful stories of our kids helping at Walmart with a Hispanic lady who was having trouble checking out, and one of our third graders just said, oh, I can help. Out in the community, our children are building these bridges.
Today on our program, building bridges through bilingual education, and from California, balancing law enforcement with civil rights of immigrants. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. With only a few states left in the primary season, Democratic presidential candidate Senator Barack Obama spent time focusing on Latino voters prior to campaigning in Pennsylvania. Joining us to discuss this and other news of the week affecting the Latino community is Univision's national news anchor, María Elena Salinas. Hola, María Elena.
Hi, María. Nice to talk to you.
As well. So, interesting week for the Obama campaign. They ended the month of March by doing two things. He named a national chairman of Latino and Hispanic fundraising, and he also called for a national holiday to celebrate the birthday of Chicano leader and labor activist Cesar Chavez, co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union. The Barack Obama campaign sent out lots of emails around this, obviously trying to create some buzz. But from your perspective, María Elena, why this and why now?
Well, why now is a lot, you know, easier to answer, because as far as supporting a national holiday in honor of Cesar Chavez, it's timely. Monday, March 31st was his birthday. And once again, Congressman Joe Baca introduced legislation to get the holiday approved. So, you know, this isn't necessarily a proposal by Obama, but more of a sign of support, hoping, of course, to seize the moment and to try to show Latinos that, you know, he supports some of their leaders. There's no political risk for him here. It's a win-win situation. So why not? And let's remember also that he's embraced one of Chavez's famous phrases, si se puede, you know, yes, we can. Now, as far as naming a Latino as the national chair of Latino and Hispanic fundraising.
It's important to mention that this Latino who was named happened to work in the Clinton administration.
Exactly. Yes, he worked in the Clinton administration. He's very well known, and I think it's just one more slap in the face, if you want to call it that, of some of the people that have supported the Clintons in the past and now are supporting Barack Obama.
Okay, let's move forward to actually your home state of California, María Elena. Union leaders there say some 20,000 janitors, 95% of whom are Latinos, are slated to go on strike by the end of the month of April. So what's the story here?
The union leaders that are representing these janitors are preparing to get tough on the negotiations. The existing contract is supposed to expire specifically on April 30th, and they already have detailed plans on what some of the union leaders will be demanding. They're asking for higher wages. They claim that they don't make enough money to be able to afford adequate housing, that they have to, several families have to live in one apartment, for example. They want improved working conditions, especially at night, which is when many janitors clean office buildings. And they want access to affordable health care for them and for their families. What the union is saying is that some janitors would actually have to work 112 hours a week in order to be able to afford to fill the basic needs for, let's say, a family of four. So, you know, they're going to be presenting some of their demands to the state legislature as early as next week, and they're hoping to get some kind of support before it's time to negotiate the contract.
All right, María Elena, let's talk a little bit about Cuba. Everybody was not sure what to expect once Raúl Castro took over from Fidel Castro. But this week, some major announcements coming out of Cuba. Cubans will now have access to hotels that were once off limits to them. They will now be able to purchase certain restricted goods. So on the one hand, people are saying this is a major change. On the other hand, people are saying, is this all for show? A lot of people, though, are pointing fingers at the one thing, the one major change, which is giving access to public lands on the part of farmers. So what's your interpretation of what Raúl Castro is doing now and why?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, in the case of giving access to public lands to those Cubans who would be willing to work them, there is more than one benefit there. But, you know, it could also help address some of the problems that they have of scarcity of agricultural products. The country is running out of food, and the government needs to, you know, make sure that their people are fed. But the bigger picture from this move and others is that the government can benefit not only by giving the impression that it is becoming a more open society, but, you know, it also helps to generate more money, and it helps their weakened economy. Cubans have to pay with convertible pesos that are not readily available. They're worth about 80 cents to the U.S. dollar. And Cubans don't earn enough money to be able to buy these convertible pesos. So what does it mean? That their families in the U.S. that send the money are basically going to be paying for that stuff, and that is going to be one way where they can get some of these convertible pesos and some of those dollars.
Okay, María Elena, well, we'll stay on top of it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, María.
María Elena Salinas is a syndicated columnist and national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish-language television network. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Imagine you're a young person who made a mistake and committed a crime. You serve your time, and then you prepare to re-enter society. But when you're released, you find that you won't be going home and that immigration officials are waiting for you to take you into custody for deportation. That's exactly what happened to Julius Damonte. From California, Nancy Mullane has his story.
Julius, we do love you, and we thank you for your friendship and your fellowship.
It was supposed to be Julius Damonte's last Sunday behind bars. After serving more than 31 years in California state prisons, he'd been found suitable for parole and was going home. So inmates and supporters filled the pews inside San Quentin's chapel to celebrate his last church service as a prisoner. As he walked down the aisle, fellow inmates dressed in orange jumpsuits and prison blues reached out to shake his hand and hug him. Standing before the congregation, Damonte said goodbye.
I am humbled before God and before everybody in his chapel today. The Lord says, I know the plans that I have for you, plans to give you hope and a future. I believe that with all my heart.
San Quentin State Prison, Lieutenant Robinson.
But 2 days later, after packing all of his belongings into four boxes, prison authorities gave him the bad news. Instead of being released to a parole officer and going to his brother's house for a homecoming meal with his family, Damonte was going to be arrested by immigration authorities.
I just found out the immigration is picking me up. You know, I'm not going straight home. I'm going to go to county jail, and I think it's going to be in San Francisco.
Minutes later, Damonte got the word it was time to go. As he made his way out of the chapel and down a long walkway to the prison's release area, guards and inmates he'd known for decades came out to say goodbye and shake his hand.
All right, bro. Take care of yourself, man.
Then a federal ICE agent approached and took control. He frisked Damonte and wrapped a heavy steel chain tightly around his waist and locked it. Damonte's hands and ankles were shackled to the chain, and he was led, shuffling his feet, to a waiting ICE van. Before closing the van's sliding door shut, the agent leaned in and, for the first time, told Damonte where he was taking him. First, he was going to a federal detention facility in downtown San Francisco. Then he would be transferred to one of four contract jails.
Either Eloy, Arizona, Yuba County Jail, Sacramento County Jail, or Santa Clara County Jail. You'll be served your warrant of deportation today, okay? Once you're processed, you'll be able to use the telephone. You'll be fed at noon, okay?
You see, even though Damonte was brought to the U.S. from the Philippines as a legal resident at the age of 11, at the age of 17, he was convicted of second-degree murder. Now, 31 years later, he's served his time. But that earlier conviction means he can be arrested and deported by ICE.
It's part of our comprehensive interior enforcement strategy to attack the criminal alien population in prisons and jails around the country.
That's Kelly Nantel. She's spokesperson for U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement in Washington, D.C. According to immigration officials, there are at least 300,000 immigrants in the U.S. whose criminal records make them eligible for ICE arrest and deportation, and not all of them are in prisons and jails. ICE officials are also scouring court documents to find immigrants who committed crimes, served their sentences, and were released before immigration officials identified them and detained them.
Whether they're legal or illegal, the program identifies them and determines if they're appropriate for removal.
At Damonte's first deportation hearing before a judge with the Department of Justice in downtown San Francisco, some 24 family members and friends showed up to support him. After being denied bail by the judge, Damonte was given a few minutes to speak with his 6 brothers and sisters, their children, and his mother, Florence Damonte, a wall of plexiglass between them.
It's hard for me because, you know, as a mother, it's hard. I don't know what to say, but... All I know is I just thank God, and hopefully, God willing, he will be out of this already. For so many years, I haven't been with him. I really miss my son.
Okay, that would be better. Okay.
Say bye, uncle. Say bye to uncle. Say bye to uncle. Bye, kiss. Hey, Julius, call us if you can. Try to call us, okay?
DeMonte was then returned to Santa Clara County Jail, where he's been incarcerated. Speaking through a phone in the visiting area, he says being in jail is worse than being in prison.
San Quentin was like Disney World compared to where I'm at right now.
As he waits for his next hearing, DeMonte holds to his dream that eventually he'll be released in California and not deported to the Philippines.
If I didn't have God in my heart, if I didn't have my faith, then I'd be miserable. You know, so I still have something to hold on to. I still have that hope that I know that he'll see me through this.
The number of immigrants with criminal histories who have been charged with deportation and have either lost or given up their legal battle is increasing. In fiscal year 2007, more than 90,000 legal and illegal immigrants with criminal convictions were deported. This year, that number is expected to jump to over 100,000. For Latino USA, I'm Nancy Mullane.
We just heard about the criminal alien program operating in California prisons, but now it's being implemented across the country. For more, we turn to Jim Harrington, director of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Welcome to Latino USA, Jim.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Exactly what is going on in terms of this program expanding? What are you seeing, for example, in the prisons in Texas?
Well, I think the problem that we see that has the greatest impact on the community is the fact that ICE has moved into the county jails in particular.
And when you say that ICE has moved into the county jails, before, like let's say a year ago, there would be no presence of ICE or immigration officials in a county jail, and now they actually have a desk, an office, a human being in the county jail?
What used to happen in the past is that the jail officials would screen the prisoners when they came in, and if they thought that somebody was worthy of drawing the attention of ICE, they would call up ICE, and ICE would come over and do the interview. But now these folks have moved into the jail. They're physically there, and they're sort of hovering around the booking desk when people come in and then try to determine their immigration status at that point. And the thing is, this could be for any sort of very petty offense. I mean, we're not talking about heavy-duty felonies where people probably ought to be deported. We're talking about traffic offenses. We're talking about what we call Class C misdemeanors here in Texas, just the bottom-level criminal offense. And what happens when somebody's arrested on this, maybe outstanding traffic tickets, then they're subjected to this scrutiny by ICE and deportation.
Let me ask you this, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who are listening who say, well, if these immigrants broke a law, you know, they should serve their time and they should be deported. So when you hear that from people, you say what?
Well, first of all, I think that people probably would agree that you should not be deported for minor offenses. And when people understand that ICE is at the jail, they're going to be very reluctant to report crime. And there's a larger context here that really bothers us, and that is in cases of domestic violence. It's going to discourage, for example, an abused wife from calling the police or the sheriff's department for help after she's gone through an incident of assault or abuse, because no matter how grievous that is, she does not want to be in the context of having her husband deported. And all of a sudden, she's sitting there having to support the kids.
So, for example, if I'm a legal resident and I have a green card, and I'm arrested for outstanding traffic violations, let's say, am I subjected to deportation?
No, if you have legal status, you're not.
If I have a green card, I'm not.
That's right.
But if I come in and I have been living in this country for 10 years and I'm undocumented and I'm arrested for the same traffic violations, I'm immediately put on the path to deportation?
Yes, that's precisely what's going on right now. And this is part of the policy that's being implemented nationwide.
You know, when you look at this nationally, what's the broader question about civil rights in this country?
Well, I think the broader question is that there ought to be some kind of equal application of the laws when we talk in terms of victims. This creates fear in the immigrant community. And when you have fear in the immigrant community, then people are not going to report crime. And then the rate of victimization of immigrants rises as a result. I would hope that nobody in this country, that no matter what they think about folks being here legally or illegally, would support the idea that you ought to have a practice in law enforcement that increases victimization and actually subjects the father or mother of the household to deportation for a traffic ticket.
So what's the solution to the problem?
Well, my solution, Maria, would be to keep things the way that they have been, in which the local law enforcement authorities look at the, when they arrest somebody, and they look at the particular kind of crime, and then they look at that person's status. And then they make the determination as to whether or not to call ICE in.
Thanks a lot for joining us on Latino USA, Jim.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Jim Harrington is the director of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Next week, we'll continue our conversation about this topic, interviewing the Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security, Julie Myers. And now, permítame que les cuente algo un poco más personal. One of the fastest growing populations in this country is prisoners, people behind bars, men, women, and yes, children. I've been visiting prisons since I was 20 years old, as a journalist, and to visit people I knew who were on the inside. The prisoners call it the small house. The rest of us, they say, live in the big house, the prison of a society where we're supposed to be free. And yet, did you know that in our free society, we now have prisons being run by private companies? What exactly does it say about us that we have corporations running detention centers? And that to many people, that simply does not sound shocking. That, in and of itself, is shocking to me. One Colorado state official who opposes the private prisons said over and over to me in my interview with her, "You have people, you have companies that are making a profit off of a body in a cell, making a profit off of a prisoner. The companies are banking on a constant and ever-growing flow of prisoners. Any reason why some corporations applaud 3 strikes and you're out? So it should come as no surprise that more and more of the private prison corporations are looking to run immigration detention centers. I'm sure that many executives in these companies are licking their bottom-line chops, thinking about how ranting TV news anchors who push for massive raids and detention are going to do great things for their profits. Immigrant prisoners making profits for corporate jailers. It all seems too strange and hard to believe. And yet, in a minute, building bridges in the Midwest con idioma, with language, coming up on Latino USA, no se vayan. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. At one time, if you stopped someone in Beardstown, a rural Illinois community, to ask them whether they thought it was a good idea for children in their local schools to learn Spanish, you'd probably get a negative reply. But these days, chances are it would be a resounding sí. From Beardstown, Illinois, Kavitha Cardosa has our story.
Walk through the main hallway of giggling, energetic children at Garda Elementary School and turn into any classroom. Chances are you'll hear something like this, math being taught in Spanish. Beardstown has seen a rapid increase in the number of Spanish-speaking immigrants, most of whom work at the Cargill meatpacking plant. And from a few students a decade ago, these children now make up about 55% of the elementary school. Teachers say the traditional method of placing Spanish-speaking children in separate classrooms until they learnt enough English to place them in regular classes was just not working. Second grade teacher Stephanie Brown says her Spanish-speaking students were seen as remedial.
The students were considered to be not very as intelligent because they couldn't speak English. It wasn't anything to do with their intelligence level, but their language.
So just 3 years ago, the school began recruiting English and Spanish-speaking parents to participate in the new dual language program, where children would be expected to become fluent in both languages, spoken and written. Almost 70% of parents opted in. Teacher Stephanie Brown says she's noticed a change in the culture of the school since the new program was introduced. She says children aren't ashamed to ask for help and they develop a respect for both languages. And Brown says she can see that when she watches them play together during recess.
They will not always get along, but now it's not, I don't get along with that child because he's different from me. It's, I don't get along with that child because he was rude or, you know, something that's acceptable.
Six-year-old Lainey Schwartz lists her friends at the school.
Eduardo, Jorge, Jesus, Ashley, and Isabella.
Behind red frames, her blue eyes sparkle when she talks about all of them playing Tag You're It in Spanish.
We run at each other and we tell things in Spanish about Tag You're It.
Like what?
Corriendo means run, and vámonos means come here.
45% of students at the elementary school are like Lainey. They speak English at home and their parents don't speak any Spanish. But most of them, such as Lainey's mother, Cindy Schwartz, have opted into the program. She says she knows there are many people in Beardstown who feel Mexicans have taken over their community and resent them. But she says she feels proud her daughter can interpret for her when they're out in the community now. Schwartz says she's also looking ahead to the long-term gains.
My daughter is going to be so marketable when she graduates college, and no better time to learn Spanish than right now. So I could be shallow about it, and I could say it's crazy, like a lot of people think, but I've been open-minded about it since day one and have been so pleased with the way that it's just phenomenal.
Teachers say this is an opportunity for their students to live a part of history. Teacher Susan Kuhn says when her students study about integration between blacks and whites in the U.S., they draw parallels between that and their present-day experiences in their own community.
When we study civil rights in our classroom, ultimately it always comes back as a conversation about that's kind of like Beardstown when the Mexicans came.
Yeah.
And it is for those first Hispanic kids that came to this mm-hmm. school. And then when the population started really growing, there was a lot of Anglo resentment in the community. They did not want these people here, just like when we integrated the schools. They didn't want blacks in their schools. And my class can already make that connection.
But having so many students who speak a different language isn't easy. Principal Cheryl Summers says at first teachers had to build up their own self-confidence, spend more time preparing coursework, and there's also a cost involved.
We had to provide more people support in the way of language facilitators, translators to do paperwork that needed to be translated, interpreters at meetings, also the materials for the students, where we had to have a lot of things in Spanish. And no matter how much the state reimburses, it doesn't cover everything.
But Summer says the most important thing is that children are learning. And she says there's hard evidence this program is exceeding their expectations. For the first time, Guard Elementary School has made all its targets for limited English speakers as measured by the federal government's No Child Left Behind standards. Consultant Deborah Cole says it's impossible for children to live in the U.S. and not learn English, but she says being able to speak both languages helps all of them participate in their own community.
We have wonderful stories of our English-speaking kids in Dual helping, you know, at Walmart with a Hispanic lady who was having trouble checking out, and one of our third graders just said, oh, I can help. Out in the community, our children are building these bridges.
Educators hope these gains will continue as they move into the higher grades. They also hope this creates better relations in this Illinois River community of 6,000 people, which has seen a dramatic change in its Midwestern culture in a short span of time. I'm Kavita Cardoza.
Growing up, it used to bug me that I could never find my name, Raul, on those little souvenir license plates that were sold at the places my family went on vacation.
What's in a name? For commentator Raul Reyes, it's all in how you look for it.
I would search through the racks of names arranged in the gift stores at Disneyland or the Grand Canyon, but Raul was never among them. This was especially annoying because I frequently saw names like Monty or Gertrude that even as a child seemed highly unusual to me. Back then, I was an assimilated Mexican-American kid living in Southern California suburbia. My family spoke English at home, just like every other family on our block. Yet periodically, I would be made aware of my differentness, and usually it was because of my name. My teachers called me Raul, Roel, or Paul. I corrected them each time, but only because my parents made me. My name was part of my heritage, they said, and I should be proud of it. My sole consolation was at least I wasn't like another kid in my homeroom named Jesus. The white kids would laugh and think it was so funny that he was named Jesus. It was just my luck, I used to think, to be stuck with a Mexican name when everyone else had regular ones. These days, I like my name just fine, and in fact, I'm feeling quite trendy. According to the Census Bureau, Hispanic first and last names are on the rise, keeping pace with the growth of the Latino population. In 2006, the most popular boy's name in Texas was Jose, while in Arizona, it was Angel. The Social Security Administration has also noted an increase in Latino names. On their list of the most popular baby names so far this decade, Angel, Juan, and Carlos all made the top 100. Oh, and by the way, Jesus is number 67 and moving up.
Raul Reyes is a New York-based lawyer and a writer for USA Today. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, UT Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. Kaufman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world. On the web at kaufman.org. And Walden University, graduate degrees online for professionals who strive to make a difference. Walden University, a higher degree, a higher purpose. waldenu.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA. On today's program, a conversation about the Department of Homeland Security's criminal alien program.
This creates fear in the immigrant community. And when you have fear, then people are not going to report crime. And then the rate of victimization of immigrants rises as a result.
Last week, we heard from critic Jim Harrington of the Texas Civil Rights Project. And today, I speak with Julie Myers from the Department of Homeland Security.
And I'll tell you one thing I hear all the time is an individual might have been arrested several years ago on a minor offense, was then kind of released into the street, and then commits a more serious crime. That's our responsibility, and that's what we're trying to focus on. Inside the jail does help us do that.
And a family scarred by immigration detention. A conversation with Haitian-American writer Edwige Danticat. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's delay of a vote on the Colombia Free Trade Agreement likely stalls the legislation until after the November election. Joining us to discuss this and other news of the week affecting the Latino community is Univision's national news anchor, Maria Elena Salinas. Hey, Maria Elena.
Hi, Maria.
All right. First of all, why should this matter to our listeners?
Well, as we see, this is a power struggle going on between the White House and Congress on the Colombian free trade issue. As we know, Democrats have refused to approve the trade agreement with Colombia, saying that country does not respect human rights and has not done enough to solve the violence against Colombian union leaders. So President Bush is saying, well, we have to support our allies in the region for national security reasons. It's such a power struggle that it has less to do with Colombia and it has to do with who wins.
Okay, Marilena, so there's this power struggle going on, but President Bush basically, he wanted this trade pact to be put on what's known as a fast track, but Nancy Pelosi changed the rules to get it off the fast track. So what is this fast track? And this is obviously where this power struggle is kind of manifesting, no?
Well, it's just that the free trade agreement was negotiated and approved between Colombia and the United States, but it hasn't been ratified by Congress. What the fast track does is that Bush sends the agreement and says you have 90 days to approve it without the possibility of making any changes. And that's where Pelosi says no way. But you know what you were asking before about why should we care about this? Bush has been talking a lot about the political consequences and the security consequences of not approving free trade agreement with Colombia, but Secretary of Commerce Gutierrez warned about the economic consequences of not accepting it. And basically what he said, since the agreement was approved 500 days ago, basically Colombia has been importing goods for free and that the United States has been exporting goods to their country at a cost of $1 trillion.
We've talked a lot about Colombia, but one of the things that we've recently been talking even more about is what's going on with the hostages, that many of whom are being held by the FARC. The past couple of weeks, there was a French government team that went in to try to see if they could negotiate a release for Ingrid Betancourt, who's been held for 6 years, the mother of two, former presidential candidate. Unfortunately, that mission failed. What happened here, Marilena?
What happened is that Álvaro Uribe had made this proposal saying, we will allow for prisoners being held to be released in exchange for Ingrid Betancourt and at least 40 of the hundreds of hostages that they have. And he's basically talking about those who are politicians, who are members of the military, police officers that are part of this bigger group that is being held hostage by the FARC. Usually what the FARC does when they have a proposal like that is that they respond through a website in 2 or 3 days. Well, this time it took a lot longer. So during this time, the French government thought it was advancing, and they sent a plane that was just sitting there waiting for a response. And when the response came out, it was not what was expected, because what the FARC have been asking for is, a demilitarized zone. If you remember, during the previous administration, there was a demilitarized zone for several years, and it was taken away. And what the rebels are saying is, we're not going to release Ingrid Betancourt or any other hostage. We've already released 6 hostages until we have this demilitarized zone, and on top of that, we release, you know, hundreds of imprisoned rebels. And that's just not going to fly with the Colombian government.
Yeah, really, really difficult story, Marilena. We'll be keeping up on that. Finally, Marilena, it came to light that the Bush administration waived environmental rules in the building of that very controversial wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. So what's going on with this?
Dozens of rules, actually, environmental laws and regulations that are going to be waived. Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff has given the green light to bypass some of these. And that's the sticky thing about this, Maria, that we're talking about Congress gave him the green light to do this and approved these waivers. Homeland Security was supposed to conduct certain environmental assessments before building parts of that wall. And what these waivers do is allow them to go ahead with the construction before these assessments are done. What they're trying to do basically is get as much of it built before the end of the administration. They're running out of money. And they realized that there could be a more immigration-friendly administration after this that could try to scrap the building of the wall. So what environmentalists have done is they've gone to the Supreme Court to try to stop the government from bypassing these laws. But, you know, this is not going to be easy because this is something that was approved by Congress, which is very questionable.
And we'll see where that one goes. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, Maria. And happy birthday, by the way.
Oh, that's right.
USA, quinceañera, right?
That's right. We're celebrating 15 years on the air. Thank you. Marilena Salinas is a syndicated columnist and national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish language television network. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Last week, we reported on a new program that's being implemented by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. The Criminal Alien Program
focuses on identifying immigrants who are incarcerated in federal, state, and local jails, and it seeks to deport those individuals. It's one of many initiatives being implemented by the Department of Homeland Security since comprehensive immigration reform fell apart last year. We're joined now by Julie Myers. She's an Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security and has been handling implementation of the Criminal Alien Program. Welcome to Latino USA, Julie.
Thanks for having me today, Maria.
So why is it that this program is being implemented now, even though there's no new immigration legislation? What was the impetus?
Well, I think the impetus really came from my desire and, frankly, the desire of Congress for ICE to do a better job in targeting criminal aliens in jails so they don't get back out into the streets of our communities.
Well, let's talk about one issue of concern, which is that you have immigrants who have committed some serious crimes, and then you have other immigrants, whether they have papers or not, who are being picked up for minor offenses, traffic violations, if their kids are truant and they have to go into a police office because of that. What do we gain as a society by roping these people in with minor offenses or if they're falsely charged? What do we as a society gain from this kind of a policy?
Well, certainly we as an agency are risk-based and focus on the individuals who pose the highest risk to our communities. I would say that individuals who are here illegally and then commit another offense, you know, have to know that they may be subject to deportation proceedings. But I certainly want to add, I'm a very strong supporter of comprehensive immigration reform. And the president, as you know, supports very strongly, and we think that that would make sense for those individuals who are not here committing crimes. But this program is really focused on individuals who've been convicted of a crime and are found in our institutions.
Do you worry that this kind of a policy really is going to create a sense of fear? I mean, you've heard this before. This is nothing new to you. This fear that's going to keep these immigrants locked down underground, is that, you know, when you think about that and what that means for a modern day America, what goes on for you, Julie?
You know, each and every day, I think about, you know, how it is that we can fairly and appropriately enforce the immigration laws. And that does include applying discretion in appropriate cases. And there are many, you know, particular cases where our lawyers choose to exercise discretion or an immigration judge chooses to exercise discretion. I do think it would make sense for our country to look seriously again at immigration reform. We as an agency have a responsibility to reduce the job magnet and to reduce the number of criminal aliens who get out on the street. And I'll tell you, one thing I hear all the time is an individual might have been arrested several years ago on a minor offense, was then kind of released into the street, and then commits a much more serious crime. And there's a lot of outrage there when that individual gets out on the street and commits a crime and causes harm to the community. And so that's our responsibility, and that's what we're trying to focus on. Focusing inside the jails does help us do that.
But essentially, you have stepped up your activities because of the fact that there was a failure of legislation moving forward in Congress. You felt the pressure to do something.
Actually, I would disagree with that. I think we've stepped up our activities ever since I came to this agency because I thought we as an agency could do better, particularly in identifying criminal aliens. And I thought it was not appropriate that convicted criminal aliens were released back into the streets of the community where they could commit another crime.
So when you hear civil liberties activists say we should not have immigration officials with a desk inside the county jails, what do you say to them?
Well, I guess I would disagree with that. I think that it's important to have a relationship with jail so that we can keep all communities safe, immigrant, non-immigrant communities, all communities safe from individuals who commit crime.
And also another criticism that says, look, if you have this kind of relationship between immigration officials and the police, it's going to mean that more immigrants, or rather fewer immigrants, whether they have papers or not, are going to come forward to report crime because they don't want to alert officials. And so, again, this pushes people further down into the underground. You know, women who are being abused by their husbands may not call the police. What about that situation, that you're going to actually be allowing crime to fester in a community because there's going to be too much fear to come forward and report it?
Certainly, you know, I'm not aware of any instance where an individual went to a police station to report a crime, and then that person was then arrested and then referred to ICE. based on that person reporting a crime. And certainly if that were to happen, I would want to know about it, and we'd look very seriously at that. And I would encourage individuals to have conversations with NGOs and others who can bring particular instances to our attention so we can take action if individuals are acting inappropriately, whether racial profiling or acting inappropriately with respect to the abuse victim. And that is something we take very seriously, and whenever there are allegations of misconduct, we move forward very rapidly.
Julie Myers, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Julie Myers is an Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security. She spoke with us by phone from Atlanta. Initiatives like the Criminal Alien Program have left many in the immigrant community wary of any interaction with government authorities, and not just with the police. From Missouri, contributor Sean Powers has this story of how fear of detention is keeping some immigrants from seeking health care for their children.
It's a cold, wet morning in Jefferson City. Maria Fernandez arrives to the historic St. Peter's Church for Sunday Mass. Maria sits near the aisle, a couple of rows from the front. After pulling out her book of hymns, she sings with her fellow congregants. As a young woman, Maria grew up in Chihuahua, Mexico, where she raised her two U.S.-born children. About 5 years ago, she moved to the U.S. with her kids after obtaining a tourist visa.
Sometimes we have to give up things.
Back at her townhouse, Maria talks about her factory job. Even though her visa does not allow her to work in the U.S., she needs to support her children. Maria is living with only one of her sons. And the only sign of her youngest, 8-year-old Kevin, is a large portrait on her desk.
In this case, I didn't give up my son, only he will be back, or I will be back to my country, but I miss him, but it's the reason I'm here.
Kevin has attention deficit disorder. While he is an American citizen and eligible for MoHealthNet, Missouri's form of Medicaid, Maria decided to send Kevin back to Chihuahua to live with his grandparents, where he could get affordable medicine. For a couple of years, Maria did apply for the state-funded care for both of her sons, but 2.5 years ago, she stopped after a representative from the Department of Social Services started questioning her legal status.
And they ask you a lot of questions and related with family and things like that, and papers or all kind of things. I didn't want to be in trouble.
She says questions about her status scared her. She worried about losing the life she built for her family. So she decided to drop her children's Medicaid.
The fact that the parent is afraid to apply because of their status is extremely sad.
Angela Ferguson is an immigration lawyer in Kansas City. Ferguson says even if the parent's immigration status is in question, the child should get the care they're entitled to.
One thing that some people can do is appoint a guardian or give power of attorney to a legal person to make that application for them. That's maybe a safer way to do it.
But Maria says the news of deportations and immigration crackdowns has made her wary of asking the government for any assistance.
I'm confused about a lot of things. Probably we don't have a lot of people that can tell us our rights, and I'm a little scared.
On Jefferson City's east side, a small white house with a fresh coat of paint is bustling with activity. This house serves as the headquarters for El Puente, a resource center for the growing Latino and immigrant community. Since 1990, the number of foreign-born Missourians from Latin America has risen by nearly 44,000, according to the nonprofit Migration Policy Institute based in Washington, D.C. El Puente's co-director, Sister Margaret Snyder, says the state is still adjusting to the population boom. And for some immigrants, especially the undocumented, there are few options.
If there are any benefits available to them, we help them access them. Otherwise, we take them to clinics that are free or a clinic that is less expensive.
After Maria dropped the Medicaid, she took her children to the Community Health Center of Central Missouri, just a couple of miles from her home.
And you're here to see the dentist, right? And you signed that paper before, right? Okay, then I'll let Troy know you're here. Thanks.
There are four part-time care physicians and one dentist who comes in once a week. Together, they treat about 30 people each day. While care at the clinic was more affordable, Maria still had trouble paying for the medication for Kevin's attention deficit disorder.
He needs some medication. He used to have a good health care here, but it's more cheaper, the medicines and the doctors and everything in Mexico.
The clinic has a translator on staff since some of the patients here don't speak English as a first language.
In our view, we have a significant shortage of primary care physicians, nurses, dentists, pharmacists, and as a country and as a state, we can make all the changes to public policy in terms of Medicaid, but if we don't have the workforce to deliver the care, you know, all those reforms are going to be for nothing.
With 60% of Missouri's clinics taking in uninsured patients, there are loopholes in which non-citizens can become eligible for Medicaid. These exceptions include military personnel, refugees, and anyone abused by their U.S. citizen spouse. Pregnant women may also receive permanent Medicaid for their unborn child and temporary Medicaid for themselves. Maria still goes to the clinic, but she no longer takes her children. Her oldest son, Victor, now has private health insurance through his job, and her youngest son, Kevin, has health coverage in Mexico. At a Mexican restaurant called El Jimador, just blocks away from St. Peter's Church, Maria and Victor snack on salsa and tortilla chips while they wait for their meals. The Fernandez talk about their future, a topic they frequently discuss. In about a year, Victor will be going to college, and Maria says she hopes he chooses a school in Mexico. While both of her children are citizens, the heightened scrutiny over immigration has made Maria wary of seeking benefits for her children here in the United States. For Latino USA, I'm Sean Powers.
In a minute, a conversation with Haitian-American writer Edwige Tanticat. Her uncle, who had a legal visa to come to the United States, died in immigration detention. Coming up on NPR's Latino USA. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We've been talking about the criminal alien program and other measures being implemented by the Department of Homeland Security to crack down on immigrants. But for some, these crackdowns are nothing new. And one immigrant community in particular has long been subject to harsh immigration restrictions and detentions. Haitian-American author Edwige Tanticat has captured this experience in her most recent book, Brother, I'm Dying. Central to her memoir is the story of her uncle Joseph, a second father, who is forced to flee Haiti in 2004, only to die in U.S. custody within days of his arrival to the United States. Author Edwige Tanticat joins us on Latino USA from Miami. Welcome to our program, Edwige.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Edwige, I have to tell you the story of how I heard about your uncle's passing. I was actually in my office at that point at CNN, and I was reading the New York Times. And there was this story about how your uncle had died in custody. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God, how could this have happened to Edwige? So for our listeners, just give us a synopsis of your uncle who had a legal visa to come into the United States and how he dies while he's being detained by immigration officials.
Well, my uncle had left Haiti on October 29th of 2004 after there was some gang violence in his neighborhood. Some of the gang members came and threatened his life. And so he decided to take the trip after hiding out in Haiti for a couple of days. He was coming, as he had been doing for about 30 years, to visit. And when he got here at Miami International Airport, he asked for political asylum. And so he was arrested and put in custody, and his medication was taken away, and he died in custody.
When you heard the way in which your uncle died in detention by immigration officials, what went on for you?
It was a shock, of course. First of all, he had been coming here for so long and didn't really want to migrate. That was never his intention. And also, he was old. He was a cancer survivor. He spoke with a voice box. He had a tracheotomy hole in his neck. He was 81 years old. So he didn't fit the profile of any menacing figure.
For me, I think what was difficult was the fact that you're a celebrated American author, and your uncle was seen as just one more person trying to get to this country, and as you said, essentially trying to take something from this country.
Well, the thing is, I understood through that whole experience, you know, of going through the bureaucracy of immigration and trying to get him released, that it's really a web, and I don't think being who I am helps any in that situation, especially, you know, in this post 9/11 period. And I necessarily was not looking for exceptionalism. I just wanted, for my uncle's sake, more than anything, fairness.
One of the things that you have done with all of your writing, Edwige, is that you have talked about the reality of Haitian immigrants in this country. Brother, I'm Dying is basically your personal tale. What was it like for you as a novelist to have to kind of reveal these personal experiences?
Well, it was certainly a different kind of writing, but I feel as though the writing I've been doing up to that moment was almost like training for writing this book, in the sense that, you know, it's like Zora Neale Hurston said, there's nothing sadder than dying with an untold story inside of you. And I felt like this is a story that I wanted to tell in this way. And maybe it's because after my daughter was born, suddenly there was, for me, an intimate audience, you know, someone who one day will be looking for clues about who she is, about her past, about our history. And of course, the realities of being in this country means that every time, you know, there's this generation, we're one generation removed from the place where we come from. And it's a mixed blessing, that reality. So I wanted to write this book in a way for my daughter, for my nieces and nephews, who may not know Haiti, certainly will not know it in the way that I knew it. I know it less than my parents did, and they will know it less than I do. So it was written with them in mind.
Thank you so much for your writing, and thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Edwige Danticat is author of Brother, I'm Dying, published by Knopf. Her other books are Breath, Eyes, Memory, The Farming of Bones, and The Dewbreaker. And now, permítame que les cuente algo un poco más personal. A year ago, I went to Jordan. It was my first time in the Middle East. Now, usually my family sends me off to faraway countries and cities here in the United States without a care. But the Middle East? I had never been to that part of the world, and my family was concerned. People and things are so different over there. Different from us, we were convinced. So, imagine my surprise when in Amman, Jordan, I come upon the same drama of undocumented immigrants that we face in this country. The drama there is that Jordanians say they're being flooded. Yes, that's the word they use. Sounds familiar, right? Flooded by undocumented immigrants. Not Mexicans, but Iraqis. The Iraqi people, men, women, and children, are fleeing a war. They are war refugees, literally running from their country to save their lives. But in Jordan, many people look at the Iraqis with the same disdain that people here have for Mexicanos. So the undocumented Iraqis are like the Mexicans in Jordan, except Mexicans are only running away from a war called poverty. In Jordan, I became friends with an Iraqi refugee. Noor Al-Khal is a poet, a journalist, and a feminist from Basra. After being kidnapped and beaten,
She was then released by her captors. They told her to run away from them, and then they shot her 3 times. At that point, Noor made the decision to break the law and cross into Jordan without papers. She was a 30-something woman with a college degree from a middle-class family who became a so-called illegal alien overnight. She had broken the law by crossing into Jordan. It was a crime. She did it to save her life. Does that make her a criminal? Noor is lucky. She's just one of a handful of Iraqis who have been granted refugee status in the United States. Here, she is finally legal. No one treats her like a criminal when she goes to pick up her immigration papers from the federal building. But not too long ago, she was living the life of an undocumented immigrant in Jordan, just like so many Mexicanos live here. And we thought things were going to be so, so different over there. Latino USA was produced this week by Benjamin Jacob, Walter Morgan, Alex Avila, and Angela Maldonado. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. We had help this week from John Berman and Steve Malagodi. To listen to our podcasts, go to latinousa.org or look for us on iTunes. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring. Catalog at lumberliquidators.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.